supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller's on assignment this evening. The violent confrontation between Philadelphia police and the radical group MOVE in 1985 will be commemorated by a state historical marker later this year. Several West Philadelphia school children were the ones who made the successful pitch for the marker. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
There were sounds of combat on Osage Avenue in West Philadelphia that day. It began with gunfire and ended with police dropping a bomb on the MOVE compound, igniting a fire that killed 11 and destroyed 61 homes. When kids at the Jubilee School, a private elementary school in West Philadelphia, took an interest in the subject, they came up with the idea of applying to the state for a historical marker. School Director Karen Falcon says the application was very detailed.
They had to document all their facts from where they got them, and they did a lot of research, and they worked really hard. And then after that, they wrote a petition to get support from the community, and they got about 200 signatures.
The kids interviewed people involved in the tragedy, including journalists who covered it and Ramona Africa, who survived the assault. Sixth grader Ella Adams says they paid a visit to that block of Osage Avenue.
We had made some poems about the MOVE bombing, so when we went down there, we decided to read them in honor of the people who died there, and we took a little walk around to see how it was.
Adams says she and her classmates worked hard to be as objective as possible in the proposed wording for the marker. Karen Galley of the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission says the final text is not yet ready. She says the kids' research was sound and the marker was approved, but there's one hitch. In 2009, the legislature eliminated funding for historical markers.
So since then, the organizations are responsible for the entire cost.
That means the students have to raise about $1,000. Falcon says they're working on that and hope for a dedication in June. I'm Dave Davies, WHYY News.
If you live in Philadelphia and work outside Pennsylvania, you might be eligible for a refund on your city wage tax, thanks to a little-known U.S. Supreme Court decision. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports.
Philadelphia's Revenue Department says if you're a resident who works in, say, Wilmington, Delaware, and you've paid that city's local tax, you can ask for that money back as a credit on your Philly wage tax bill. And you can thank a 2015 U.S. Supreme Court ruling on a Maryland case. The High Court found that it's unconstitutional to have commuters pay the same taxes in two states on the same income. The credit likely applies to a small number of people, but CPA Rosalind Such says eligible Philadelphians could be leaving money on the table.
What taxpayers don't realize is that they're due these refunds and they have to file a refund petition in order to ask for that refund. So no one is just going to send them that refund check.
Tax attorney Stuart Weintraub says the refund would apply to more people if Philadelphia's interpretation of the Supreme Court ruling went one step further.
What they oppose is allowing a similar credit for the taxes paid to the state where the Philadelphia resident employee is working.
That would give Philadelphians who work in New York, for example, a pretty significant refund. It has some of the highest state income taxes in the country. A spokesman for the city's revenue department says Pennsylvania already allows residents to offset taxes paid to other states. Weintraub says he plans to challenge the city on that in court. I'm Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Attendees at the National Constitution Center this evening will view a screening of the film VA, The Human Cost of War, followed by a panel discussion focusing on the men and women who put their lives on the line so that we may enjoy our freedom and what they're deserving of upon their return. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller sat down with the film's executive producer, Lois Pope, and discussed how she became invested in helping disabled veterans after seeing the graphic toll of war.
Let's first talk about your journey. A native Philadelphian, where and when did you first get this passion for this important cause?
My journey's been a long one. It goes back to the 1960s.
In New York?
In New York, and I was a performer. I was a Broadway performer in musicals. I was asked to do a benefit I didn't know who it was for, but at the Rusk Rehabilitation Center. So I agreed to do that benefit, and when I went there to the Rusk, which is part of New York University Hospital, by the way, I walked into an auditorium. And when I walked into that auditorium, I was shocked because what I saw there was unbelievable. I saw men. There were no women then. Men without eyes, blinded, just holes for ears, holes for nostrils, hobbling on crutches. They were all Vietnam veterans. I did not know that when I went there. Then I thought, oh, my God, one of the songs that I brought with me was Somewhere from West Side Story. It was a very popular show then. And if I had thought about it and what I had would have seen, what I did see, I wouldn't have brought that song because of the lyrics. All of a sudden, the piano played, and I had to sing. And when I got to that line, hold my hand, and I'll take you there. There was a man, I held out my hand to the man lying on a gurney, and he had no hand for me to hold. That changed my life. It changed my life, and it changed my life forever. As I sit here now, it's just changed my life. And I decided then and there that if ever I could, I would do something for these veterans, these brave men. However, I was a struggling artist then. I had no money. I had no means. My husband died in 1988, and all of a sudden I had the means. In the meantime, I did go to the Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. On the way out of that park, I asked the park guard, I said, where is the memorial for disabled American veterans? And he said, there isn't one. That's when I made up my mind to build a memorial for disabled American veterans.
And so, indeed, it was just a few weeks ago when you spoke at the Dedication for the American Veterans Disabled for Life Memorial in the nation's capital.
From the memorial, I thought, how come people didn't know about these 4.3 million disabled vets? How come I didn't? I had a fairly good education. I went here to very good schools, Melrose Academy, Chestnut Hill College. How come I didn't know? I mean, no history books tell us, though, how many people come back disabled for life. They didn't tell us what I saw that day at the Rusk. 6 months before the memorial was finished, I called Rick and Bonnie Burns of Steeplechase Films. And I said, you know, not everybody is going to be able to see this memorial. I haven't done my job. And I said, I want to do a documentary and educate people about what I found out. And I didn't know. I want everyone to know about this. Why? Where it started and start with the very beginning in American history and go forward right up to present times. Dead of Honor is the name of that documentary. It's fantastic. Then after that, I thought, okay, I learned from doing that documentary that my job wasn't finished because a lot of these people were not getting adequate care in the VA hospitals. I thought, is it because Congress isn't giving enough money? And they're second, the VA is second in budget to the Department of Defense.
It's the second largest bureaucracy in the nation.
And that's what you can, that's it. You said it, bureaucracy. It's a bureaucracy from hell. That's what it is.
I suspect you still don't feel you're finished yet, even though human cost of war has been produced and is out and about. What's next?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what's next, but I am not finished yet.
Talk about the Facebook project, What Do We Owe Our Veterans?
I decided that when I did this film, Dead of Honor, The Human Cost of War, that we would go to the social media. I want to hear what Americans, not just me, I want all Americans to participate and to become part of this conversation. So I want them to go to Facebook, and the question is, what do we owe our veterans? And I think they're going to say, in a country like this, they're going to say, oh, my God, we owe them everything, because if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be here enjoying our democracy, our freedom, the American way of life.
Lois Pope, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
VA, The Human Cost of War, screening this evening at the National Constitution Center, followed by a panel discussion. Lois Pope will be there, as will award-winning filmmaker Rick Burns and an esteemed panel. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
Next week, the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to vote on Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. A full vote in the Senate could soon follow. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports Gorsuch is not finding much support among Democrats from our region.
If you've tuned into the debate over the Gorsuch nomination, you may be surprised by how much another person's name has been brought up. That's because Democrats are still smarting over the GOP's move to deny the open seat on the high court to President Obama's choice, Merrick Garland.
What the Republicans did to Merrick Garland was unprecedented and shameful.
That's Senator Tom Carper from Delaware. The Democrat is seen as a soft-spoken statesman. But when it comes to the GOP not even holding hearings or a vote on Garland, you can tell Carper is still steaming. That's why he plans to vote against Gorsuch.
I'm not prepared to support moving the nomination until we've actually taken up and dealt with the last nomination. Merrick Garland never got almost anybody to meet with him. Certainly never had a hearing for a minute. Never had a chance to be heard in a public hearing. Certainly didn't get a cloture vote.
But Republicans brush aside those criticisms.
It's totally irrelevant.
That's Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania. He's the only Republican representing our region in the Senate. He says he and his colleagues aren't debating Merrick Garland. They're now supposed to be debating Neil Gorsuch.
I've heard no credible substantive attacks. He is an outstanding choice. I can't imagine a better choice for the Supreme Court.
With Democrats like Carper threatening to do anything in their power to block Gorsuch, possibly employing a filibuster to keep him locked out, Republicans are threatening to unleash the so-called nuclear option. That would drop the threshold for approving Supreme Court justices from 60 to 51 votes. Toomey says he's on board with the plan to confirm Gorsuch no matter what, even if that changes a long-standing Senate tradition.
Well, let me just put it this way. We're going to confirm Neil Gorsuch one way or another, and I support his confirmation.
Democrats employed a limited nuclear option when they were in power by lowering the threshold for confirming federal judges from 60 to 51. Democratic Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania says there's a reason they didn't lower the threshold for nominees to the high court. He says the GOP may be making a grave mistake.
Well, they shouldn't. We certainly didn't go in that direction. And it was my position has been if you're a truly consensus candidate, you ought to be able to rack up 60 votes. I don't think that's unreasonable.
Senator Chris Coons of Delaware serves on the Judiciary Committee. He has had two private meetings with Gorsuch and sat through his four long days of confirmation hearings. Like many Democrats, Coons complains Gorsuch didn't give straight answers to many of his questions, but he says he's still making up his mind.
He's very intelligent. He's charming. He's not particularly responsive to questions, but he was very affable in declining to respond to questions.
Coons says he still doesn't know if he can trust Gorsuch on a number of issues, ranging from privacy rights to LGBT issues.
As I think you could tell from my line of questioning, I had some real concerns about just how far out of the mainstream his opinions are in a couple of different areas.
The Judiciary Committee is set to vote on Gorsuch on Monday, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has promised he'll be confirmed by the full Senate by Friday, April 7th, even if he has to deploy the nuclear option over a Democratic filibuster. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Politics is at play regarding Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch's confirmation vote, but how does American public feel about it? In this week's edition of What Are We Thinking? NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller and Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, find out. They start by taking a look at Pennsylvania.
Frank, Pennsylvania is a case study of the partisan divide. Democratic Senator Bob Casey threatens a filibuster, to which Senator Pat Toomey warns the Republican majority will, quote, do what it takes to ensure Gorsuch's ascendancy to the top court. Where does the public weigh in?
45% of Americans say that the Senate should vote in favor of him, 32% not in favor. You know, that's not that out of line with how Americans have reacted to other recent nominees, like Elena Kagan, almost exactly the same percent. She was, of course, nominated by Obama back in 2010, said that she should be confirmed.
Interesting. I read recently that when last year Republicans decided to ignore Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland, it cost them nothing politically, despite the polls showing support for hearings and a vote for him.
Well, we'll wait and see what happens, of course, with this current nominee. Republicans overwhelmingly want him to be confirmed, 74%. And that's interesting because it shows that Americans, when we ask this question, are clearly aware of the fact that he is a Trump appointee. Democrats, only 21% say that he should be confirmed.
Pulling back from this particular matter, is there a sense of how Democrats think they should deal with the Trump administration going forward?
Yeah, this is very fascinating. We have asked a question in the past, and I think we've even talked about it, about generically, should people in Congress go along, that is, compromise in order to get things done, or should they stick to principles? And historically, back when we had the Tea Party very much in favor and slowing down, shutting down government, we had Democrats saying that members of Congress should compromise rather than sticking to principle. Republicans more likely to say stick to principle. Well, we just asked that question now just about Democrats. We said, and we ask all Americans this question, should Democrats in Congress compromise with President Trump in order to get things done, or should they not and stick to principles? Well, lo and behold, now we've had a flip. Democrats nationally, strongly, a majority of Democrats say that Democrats in Congress should stick to principles and not compromise with President Trump. While Republicans, of course, say the Democrats should. So, where are we? Well, we've got a looming shutdown of government up and coming near the end of April, and clearly rank-and-file Democrats are saying to their people, their representatives in Congress, don't compromise.
Let's put that looming shutdown aside for a moment, and this must have been an interesting challenge for Gallup, polling Russians about Russia.
We have done that for many years. In our Gallup World Poll, we interview all around the world, and we interview in Russia. We've asked about, in particular, the leader, Vladimir Putin. And right now, I can tell you, these are data based on 2016 interviews. It takes a while for us to process those, but 81% of Russians say that they approve of the job Vladimir Putin is doing as president of Russia. And that stayed high, actually, for the last 3 years. Putin got a rally effect, a bump, as it were, when Russia invaded Crimea. Russian approvals of Putin went up, and they've stayed up very high since that point.
Though if you look back over the past 8 years, it's ranged from a high of 85%. The low was 54%, and I'm not sure what the Russian equivalent of a Brady effect would be, but is there a chance that some respondents were afraid to say anything but positive things about Putin?
Well, that's a good question, Dave. We use Russian interviewers who are very professional and do interviewing all the time in Russia, market research individuals, firms that we hire and do that. But it's very difficult for us to know exactly what's going through Russian respondents' mind, even if they're given the promise of anonymity when they answer that question. All we know is, based on asking the question, over 8 out of 10 say yes, they approve of Vladimir Putin.
Were Russians just as forthcoming and positive when asked to evaluate their economy or, say, corruption?
That's an interesting point. They were clearly quite willing to say there was corruption in Russian government. Widespread corruption, those are the two words we use. 75% of Russians say yes, there's widespread corruption in Russia. And that's not uncommon. A very high percent of Russians have said there is corruption for many years now.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
An original painting by Norman Rockwell, stolen from a family home in Cherry Hill 40 years ago, is back where it belongs. The FBI recovered the long-lost painting based in part on damage it sustained during a game of pool. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the case of the Wild Cue Stick.
In 1954, a man named Robert Grant of Cherry Hill, New Jersey, was playing pool at a friend's house when he lost control of his stick and it pierced a nearby painting. As consolation, he bought the damaged picture for $75. It was an original Norman Rockwell. Painted in 1919 for the Saturday Evening Post, it depicts a farm boy taking a nap against a tree trunk. It's called Taking a Break, or Lazy Bones. Grant's daughter, Susan Murda, said that picture became part of the family.
My father adored it, so we all loved it. It was in every picture when we were little, in the background. He loved it, and so we did too. And when it was stolen, he was heartbroken.
In 1976, a burglar broke in, stole the painting, along with the TV and a coin collection. And that thief, who was still unidentified, sold it for a few $100 to an antiques dealer in the area who assumed it was a copy. The dealer could not find a buyer, so he hung it in his kitchen. Cut to four decades later, 2016, when the media reported on the 40th anniversary of the cold case. The antiques dealer recognized the paintings in the reports and promptly turned it in. FBI Special Agent Jake Archer says damage from that pool cue 60 years earlier was key to cracking the case.
It helped us realize that we were on the right track. We still needed to have it professionally attributed to Rockwell, but needless to say, it was a major clue.
It's impossible to say what the painting is worth now, but similar Rockwells have been recently auctioned for well over $1 million. The curator at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Massachusetts, Martin Mahoney, says the painting's distinctive damage may actually increase its value.
The damage is part of the story, and it becomes part of the provenance. It's how the FBI helped identify it. It's how the family has a very deep connection with the piece, and in some ways it adds certain value to it.
Now, whenever the family sees that telltale hole in the bottom left of the canvas, they think of their father, or their grandfather, and how much he loved the painting. They have not yet decided what to do with it. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. The news director, Eugene San. John Mussoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineer this week was Anand Stanishevitz. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.